Welcome to Missing the Mouse, episode 4. We're going to start this episode off with a little follow-up from last week, because if you can believe it, the whole hour and 20-minute episode, we missed some stuff.
Well, we didn't miss some stuff. I missed some stuff.
No, so. Brad missed some stuff.
Yes, yes. Let's put it all on, at my feet and on my back. Yeah, there were actually just two things that, in looking back, I felt like we should have covered. And, of course, the first thing is something that you and I were very excited about, both in discussions, and that was the Glow with the Show ears.
Right.
Yeah, so I did get Glow with the Show ears, and I did get to use them with World of Color. Actually, the sad thing is, the second day when we went back, when we went to Disneyland, I left my Glow with the Show ears in the car, so I did not use them with the fireworks or Fantasmic.
Come on, Brad.
Yeah, I know. $25 pair of ears, and I leave them in the car. But, you know, the World of Color told me enough about them, and unfortunately, I'm not sure that they're actually worth it. And I don't know. I have my pair. I'm glad I have my pair. Given the option, I would buy them again, but here's the number one issue with Glow with the Show ears. They don't sell that well because they're so expensive, and if you spent $25 on something that's going to flash in time with the show, you want to see what's glowing with the show. And the one person around you that can't see the Glow with the Show ears is you, because they're on top of your head. So that was kind of the dilemma I found myself in. You know, I'm at World of Color. There was one person way off to my far right that I could kind of see their Glow with the Show ears going. And then I don't think I saw anybody with them at the fireworks or at Fantasmic. And I'm sure there were a couple of pairs spread out. There just were none in my field of vision. You know, and that's kind of disappointing, because you and I were talking about, prior to me leaving for this trip, you know, I think we've both seen the YouTube clips where they show, you know, Fantasmic now with World of Color and Fantasmic now with the Glow with the Show ears. You see these awesome effects taking place throughout the audience, right?
Right, when they give them away to get those videos.
There you go, and that's the key. If they give them away, it's an awesome thing, and you get to see everybody else using them. If you're going to go by yourself, you know what? Here's the thing. If you have kids, buy a set for your kids and put them on their head, because, you know, they'll be nice lower, so you can keep an eye on the show, and you can have your little Glow with the Show ears going right in front of you. But if I had it to do over again, I would probably put my Glow with the Show ears on my wife, so that way I could watch them.
So you could see the fruits of your $25.
That's right. I want to see the fruits of my my money that came from my labor. But you know, so anyway, so that covers the Glow with the Show ears. And then there was one other thing that I wanted to cover. And again, with the nighttime shows, and it was World of Color. They've done something here that I haven't seen with any other Disney show. And that is, in the pre-show, you can take your smartphone, and they have a Wi-Fi network. It's Peer Games Wi-Fi network. You connect to it, and the network doesn't even go live till about, I think it was about 15 minutes before the show. You connect to this network, and it basically, no matter what, you know, you can type in google.com or whatever, and it's going to redirect you to a website where basically you play a Simon game. But here's the thing. The way the Simon game works, it's actually the wheel, the
Mickey's Fun Wheel?
Yes, Mickey's Fun Wheel is actually lighting up with different colors in different patterns. And then as soon as it gets done lighting up, you then have to go on your phone and quickly tap out what you just saw on the wheel. And you're playing against everybody else who's actually watching the same show as you. So everybody's connected to this Wi-Fi network. And there's, I think two rounds happened during the pre-show. At the end of each round, whoever had the highest score actually got to control the wheel for 30 seconds, got to control the colors of the wheel, the patterns on the wheel, everything for 30 seconds. You got control of the wheel.
Cool.
Yes. So number one, I was extremely impressed with how well this works, because, you know, coming from a technical standpoint, the idea of that many devices connecting to a Wi-Fi network, hosting a game on it, and somehow keeping track of everything on something that's very much a quick reflex type of thing through a browser, that was awesome. I mean,
yeah.
props to Disney for getting that out there. And number two, I'd love to see them doing this with all their shows, because it gave you something during the pre-show to do that was, you know, very fun, very engaging. And honestly made that wait feel a whole lot shorter because I had something to focus on.
Yeah, so. That's cool. I'd heard a little bit about that. I didn't realize it was a Simon game. I thought it was kind of just a everybody can control the wheel for 30 seconds and just, you know, queue up in a virtual line, and when it becomes your turn, you get to mess with it. But it's all done. It's all a game. Did you win either round?
I did not win either round, and I think the game is fixed because I know I hit the button fast. That's right, Disney. I am on to your conspiracy to not give me control of the wheel. No, I did not win, but you know, it's just interesting because you're hearing people around you going, "Oh man, I just got, you know, 6,527," and you're like, "I got 6,528," you know, and so you're playing against all these people and you know what's going on, and I don't know, it's just it's a very cool experience. It's a neat addition. And I'd like to see them do it more places. That's, you know, that's kind of my takeaway from that is I want to see, you know, the fireworks now have some sort of a game involved in. And all of the shows that I'm going to have to sit and wait for, I'd love to see them do this in some of the queues. You know, Mission Space is a 45-minute wait, but here you can play a little game against everybody else in line. And again, I think that comes back to that, you know, the gamification like we were talking about with Toy Story Mania, things like that. It's just, it's fun to do, so.
And stuff like that is relatively cheap to maintain. You know, once they get it installed, maintenance is relatively inexpensive, and that would definitely make, you know, like you said, a 45-minute wait a little more bearable.
Right, so, you know, there's Disney's free tip of the day. You know, some Imagineers welcome to steal that idea as long as it actually gets used. That's all I really care about. give me some games to play. During my wait, Disney. That's all I asked for.
Yeah, so. That'd be awesome.
Anyway.
Well, on to today's topic. I recently was listening to the Golden Horseshoe Review, which is an excellent Disney Parks podcast, if you are looking for another one. And they were talking a bit about Tokyo Disney Sea, which is a park that I don't know that a lot of people have ever heard of. You know, there's Disneyland Paris, there's Tokyo Disneyland, Hong Kong Disneyland, things like that. But Tokyo Disney Sea is kind of one of those really obscure parks that I don't know that a lot of people really know about. And just to give a little bit of background, it's in Tokyo. It's the California Adventure to Tokyo Disneyland, or it's the California Adventure. What California Adventure is to Disneyland, Tokyo Disney Sea is to Tokyo Disneyland. So it's kind of its separate park. Opened in 2001. The interesting thing to me is that Tokyo Disneyland and Tokyo Disney Sea are both not owned by the Walt Disney Company. They're the only two Disney parks that are not owned by that company.
Yeah, it's a very cool thing when you find that out and you're like, oh, so they're actually just kind of licensing all this out now to this Japanese company.
Right, and it's the Oriental Land Company. Now, the reason I wanted to talk about it is because Tokyo Disney Sea is widely regarded as the best Disney park and the best theme park in the world. And Brad has actually been there. I have not.
I have.
And so I just wanted to kind of, you know.
You want to know why people actually say it's that good, right?
Right. What makes it the best theme park in the world? That's a big thing to say.
It is. And you know what? I have not been to every theme park in the world, but of the theme parks that I've visited, you know, and it's probably not saying nearly as much because of the theme parks that I've visited, Disney is still head and shoulders above anything else that I've been to, just as a overall, any of the Disney parks, even Disneyland Paris, which I would actually put on the low end for Disney parks, is still head and shoulders above them. But yes, Tokyo Disney Sea just takes things to a whole new level. And I think a lot of that really comes down to it does what Disney already does well better than any other Disney park. And when I say that, I'm thinking about really just the overall feel of when I step into a Disney park. And you know, this was something that you discussed in talking about Disneyland. When I step into a Disney park, I feel like I have been whisked away from where I was into a whole different place.
Right. And that's the best thing ever.
Yeah. And any Disney park really does this to an extent, but the theming just goes so much further inside of Tokyo Disney Sea that I think it builds upon that and expands upon that to so much a greater level than any of the Disney parks really do. And it's really something that I'd love to see a lot of the stateside parks actually strive for is this. But I think I really think that it opened things up for the, Imagineers, because again, as you said, this is not owned by Disney, but is owned by Oriental Land Company. But, Imagineers still, played an integral role in everything that's there. Disney still played an integral role in making decisions about how things were placed and where they were placed and everything. I think once we freed the Imagineers from the I hesitate to say the word shackles, but the shackles of Magic Kingdom, or Disneyland, which then turns into Magic Kingdom, which then turns into Disneyland Paris, which then turns into Tokyo Disneyland and Hong Kong Disneyland. There's a blueprint there. There's a template there that they're required to do. And with Tokyo Disney Sea, you just feel like, those creative juices really got spinning again because they were no longer held under this. We have to keep it to a certain standard that was set here. And that's not to take anything away from, the awesomeness that is Disneyland and all the different permutations of that park.
Right.
But it's just awesome to see, kind of their imaginations run wild again, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And again, something I hesitate to say because, I don't really want to, I never want to be negative Disney, but I feel like they had a lot less restrictions on money and things like that compared to some of the stateside parks because, you look at Animal Kingdom and you look at, Disney's Hollywood Studios, but even more so Animal Kingdom because that's the, those are the two newer parks over there. And, you just feel like they made decisions based upon, they wanted a really, really cool park, but then they were also making decisions based on what was monetarily sound, what the, budget called for and things like that. And that could be the case at Tokyo Disney Sea as well, but honestly, it feels like the budget was just busted wide open, and they said, let's see what kind of cool things we can do.
Yeah, I believe that other than some insane theme park soon to come in Dubai, Tokyo Disney Sea is the most expensive theme park in the world as well. Apparently they just kind of threw money at them and said, hey, make this thing awesome. But it's funny you talk about the Animal Kingdom, because Tokyo Disney Sea and the Animal Kingdom kind of share this monument almost in the very middle of the park where the Animal Kingdom has that big tree of life. Tokyo Disney Sea has Mount Prometheus, an enormous, volcano that is, coincidentally the exact same height as Cinderella's castle in Tokyo Disneyland. But, they have that, which, I think everything in this park kind of ties into this same kind of mythos and the same kind of story. Mount Prometheus is in Mysterious Island, which is one of seven, sections of this park. So whereas Disneyland and Walt Disney World Magic Kingdoms have Adventureland and Tomorrowland, the Tokyo Disney Sea has things that are water themed. You have Mediterranean right. Harbor, Port Discovery, Arabian Coast, Mermaid Lagoon, the American Waterfront, Lost River Delta, and Mysterious Island, where Mount Prometheus is. And so they've really focused on the sea, which makes sense since the name of the park is Disney Sea. But I've also heard that and read that it's a little more for adults than kids. Some of the rides are a bit more scary and a bit faster and higher, and that it really caters more to an older crowd.
I think there's a lot of truth to that compared to Tokyo Disneyland. There are sections of Tokyo Disney Sea, just as with any Disney park, I think of kind of like a Bugs Land in California Adventure, where it's more directly in the mermaid section of that at Tokyo DisneySea is much more of the children's thing. But yeah, you have things like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and you know, and Journey to the Center of the Earth, mm-hmm. and you know, Indy in the Crystal Skull, which, you know, if you've ridden in Anaheim, you've pretty much ridden that attraction.
Okay.
The Tower of Terror, you know, again, we get some of those Disney rehashed attractions, but if you notice, we're talking about a lot more of the, as you said, more intense, more adult-oriented attractions than what you really see. And, you know, and it's kind of like in Epcot. If you go to Future World, you kind of get the, it's fun for all ages. If you go to the countries, a lot of people will try, you know, especially if you've got younger children, I understand you're going to try to kind of work your way through those things as fast as you can. But I personally feel like as you get older, you grow to appreciate those things more and more, mm-hmm. and get to see all the cool architecture and just all the, again, attention to detail that Disney puts into that. And that's kind of, again, taken to a whole new level at Tokyo DisneySea.
Right. Right. And, yeah, I'm just looking at the attractions and stuff that are available there. And like you said, Tower of Terror is there, the Indiana Jones, you know, but they've got the Storm Rider and Raging Spirits and just these attractions and rides that even sound more frightening. You know, Space Mountain sounds a lot cooler than it does scary, and Mission Space sounds neat. You know, something like Storm Rider and Raging Spirits kind of denotes a bit more of a intense ride than a fun one.
Right. And the funny thing is, you know, you talk about that, and you know, Storm Rider is interesting in that it's really kind of a Body Wars or Star Tours type thing, the moving auditorium.
Oh, okay.
With a little bit more 4D added in. There's some water feature added into it and things like that. It's a very cool attraction, but again, it's kind of, you're all sitting in that auditorium. You see the things on the screen, all that sort of stuff. And, you know, I find it extremely amusing that you bring up Raging Spirits as, you know, one of those more adult attractions, because that was actually one of the ones that I was kind of let down by, because it was actually pretty light on the theming in comparison to everything there. And it was actually kind of slow for a coaster as well. It was just kind of shoehorned in there as a small outdoor coaster. But anyway,
kind of like the Walt Disney World and Disneyland Big Thunder Mountain.
This one actually does have a loop in it. So okay. I guess that has something for it, but you know, that's kind of its big selling point, and it still felt slow overall. But but again, like you said, these are still attractions that, you know, you don't want to take. I probably wouldn't want to take a kid on Storm Rider, because you know, lightning hits your ride vehicle, and it gets, you know, it gets bumpy, it gets a little scary. And you know, Star Tours, I guess if your kid's seen Star Wars, they can tie into those characters and get some comfort from that. You're not going to have that in Storm Rider. And you know, the same thing with Raging Spirits, that's still at its heart a roller coaster, and for some younger children that would probably be an issue. So yeah, it does, it those rides do have more of a tie, I think, to an older audience overall.
And then do they have at DisneySea anything like Autopia, or is that kind of, is that,
you're probably looking at what Aquatopia, which is actually nothing like Autotopia. You would think so. You know, Autotopia, it's the big selling point there is you can drive your car around. That would be an attraction that I could see taking a small child or smaller child to, because basically, I feel like the best way to explain that ride would be to say, if you've ever seen the Main Street Electrical Parade or any permutation thereof, there's this one section where these little bugs are running around and they just spin around randomly. They drive back and forth to either side of the street with no apparent rhyme or reason. We all know that, you know, there's something in there that's giving them rhyme or reason, but we can't tell, because they just move to one side, move back to the other, do a couple spins. Basically, if you jumped inside of one of those, that's what Aquatopia is, because you're on this little lagoon area and you're being driven around from one section to another, and your ride vehicle will spin around, and it's a fun attraction, but not a whole lot of rhyme or reason to it. So, Yeah, that's kind of what Aquatopia really brings to the party. So, you know, I guess there you could have something for smaller children, but.
Yeah, I've kind of always, over in Tomorrowland, you know, Space Mountain is over there, but then Star Tours and kind of Buzz Lightyear Space Ranger Spin and Autopia are kind of just over there for the parental set. Well, you got a little kid and you want them to be able to do something. And I guess to a little kid, driving a car around is pretty exciting.
Oh, I remember being a child, you know, prior to turning 16. And, you know, I was always wishing my parents would take me to Disney because, you know, you got to drive a car and you actually got to control the car. You could control the wheel. And, you know, there is still that track there, but you've got a little bit of give. And then once I turned 16, I wasn't nearly as excited about that. But yeah, it's a huge thing if you're a kid, and you can tell that at any time by looking at the line there. But yeah, so definitely, you know, they've got some rides there that are there to flesh out. And I feel like Raging Spirits and Aquatopia kind of provide that, you know, let's flesh out the available rides, you know, and those aren't the e-ticket attractions, but they provide a valuable service in giving people other things to do other than the e-tickets, so the e-tickets aren't just insanely long lines all the time.
Tower of Terror, best e-ticket there?
You know, yes, I would say so. I would say so. But this is for me personally. I could very easily seeing someone say that Journey to the Center of the Earth is the best e-ticket there, and I would be hard-pressed to disagree with them. But for me, I like Tower. I like Tower at Walt Disney World. I like it at Disneyland. But, you know, and we discussed this in our favorites episode, in episode one.
Right.
The biggest thing to me about the Tower there is just that I think we both agree that Disney Hollywood Studios, it's well themed, you know, but I think they again took it to another level when they had it, when they built it there at Tokyo Disney Sea, and by not having the Twilight Zone to fall back on as kind of, you know, this tying thing in Tokyo, because, you know, that was never a big thing in Tokyo, so they can't. They could have done that, but it would not have created the images in people's minds of, okay, this is the Twilight Zone. I know what to expect.
Right.
They would have been like, what's this random show that Disney made up to sell off this thing? So they go with this totally different sell-off where, you know, you've got this big millionaire that was, has been all around the country collecting these things for his hotel, and, you know, mysteriously disappears after collecting an idol under some, you know, very weird circumstances. And the hotel gets opened up and you're walking through and you get to walk through these big areas where, you know, you can see, you know, like old Egyptian artifacts and things in some rooms. Is again, just through the queue area.
Mm-hmm.
And then you come through and you see Shariki, who is the idol that he's gotten, you know, going through the ride and everything. It really creates a whole different ride there. I did not feel like I was, if I go to Disney Hollywood Studios, I'm riding the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror. If I go to Disneyland, I'm riding the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror. And it's for the most part, the same attraction. This one felt like a whole different attraction that just happened to take place in the same ride vehicle.
Right. And for me, that really shows, like you were saying earlier, how the Imagineers just kind of got to go nuts and build their own story, you know, like the Twilight Zone kind of, you got Rod Serling, you have, you know, expectations. And with this, I mean, the Imagineers were like, okay, we need a story that makes sense. What you got, you know, and they made this very interesting story that you're not going to find anywhere else. And, you know, that it really serves as a way to get people to go to that park, you know, travel there and say, I got to experience this for myself because it sounds awesome.
Yeah. And I feel like you need to go and experience, you know, that is one of those attractions that you really do need to go and see because it is so unique. And that's a great thing, especially for people like us that are Disney nuts. You know, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror is not going to be a pull for me to go to Disneyland Paris because it's the exact same Tower of Terror that I've seen at Walt Disney World already, and right. I didn't even have to fly over any, you know, large body of water to get to it.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, I will go to Disneyland Paris to go see their take on the Haunted Mansion because it's actually a totally different take from what the other parks have. And that's what, you know, and so that's what Tokyo has done here with the Tower of Terror. Is they've created a whole different feel to this attraction. And I would really personally like to see Imagineers get opportunities to do this more often, because seeing what they can accomplish there tells me, you know, let's let them take one take of Tower of Terror in Walt Disney World, and then let's let them go crazy, give them the same ride vehicle so we don't have to rethink that, but let's let them think up a whole new story for it at Disneyland, you know, so that there's a reason to go visit both of them, yeah. To me.
And so Journey to the Center of the Earth, second or equal best e-ticket. Why?
Again, I think because of theming, really. Because it's very much a similar experience to... I liken it to Expedition Everest. In fact, it's even got a, you know, huge audio animatronic, very much like Expedition Everest does. It's a roller coaster like Expedition Everest is. But, again, the thing that kind of sets it over the top for me is attention to theming. And Disney's Animal Kingdom, Expedition Everest, I love the theming in that place. I love the way that they set you up. You're going through Nepal. They give you all these different Bigfoot lore to look at.
Yeah, the queue to that ride is amazing.
Exactly.
It's almost a crime to fast pass Expedition Everest.
Yeah. You don't mind as much when you get stuck in a long line if you can constantly walk through area after area where you've got cool things to look at on the walls, there are things to read, and that's, you know, of course in Tokyo, you know, some of it's actually going to be in English, a lot of it's not going to be, so good luck with that. But, you know, there's so many cool things to look at. In fact, I think to me the highlight of that queue for Journey to the Center of the Earth was so again, this is all taking place inside of a volcano, and the queue is long enough that they put some water fountains in the queue for you to stop and grab a drink while you're... Yes, it was that bad. You know, I don't really remember it being super long.
Maybe Japanese hospitality.
There you go, which we can discuss after this as to another reason why Tokyo Disney Sea is so great. But you're walking through the queue, and there are these water fountains there. One of the water fountains has actually had the lava flow over it so much that all that you can see is the very top of a water fountain spout sticking out of the lava. So it looks like there should be, I think, maybe three water fountains there, but there are only two that are usable, and one is just sticking, you know, all that you can see is a spout left over. So it looks like they built water fountains here, and there was a lava flow that came over the water fountains in the queue.
That's so cool.
Yeah, and it's just, so again, it's that attention to detail, the imagination running wild that makes these things more than just a roller coaster, makes these things more than just a free fall ride. And I think that's why people look at Tokyo Disney Sea and say it's set apart from the other amusement parks that are out there.
Yeah. And that's so Disney to put a destroyed water fountain in there just for the sake of fun.
Right. Just to go for the sake of fun and just for the sake of, We want to imprint this story in your mind and make it seem so realistic. So we're gonna, you know, we're going to add things like this. And again, you know, you kind of hit upon, you know, that Japanese hospitality. I really do think that is another big selling point for Tokyo Disney Sea and Tokyo Disneyland. Is just there is an insane attention to cleanliness in those parks. To keeping everything looking tip-top shape all the time. And, you know, it is a matter of personal pride for, you know, not just the management, but it seems like every cast member there takes it very personally that this, you know, that I'm going to make this park look as good as I can. And I think that plays out in the overall experience that you have in the parks there.
As opposed to what I've read about Disneyland Paris, which has a horrible reputation for cleanliness and maintenance, it's good to know that in Tokyo they take it pretty seriously.
Yeah, so like I said, Tokyo Disney Sea, just an incredible experience. if you want to see what can happen when Imagineers are not are just able to go to their wildest dreams and do whatever it is that they want to do, I feel like that's the park to go to. And I would be surprised if anybody ever came back disappointed from a trip to that park, you know?
Yeah. Oh, that's it for this episode. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Have a magical day.